Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabbit.
Good morning, good morning. And we have, when I was categorizing the people for today's program, suggesting them to Ann, I put at the top of the page legends. Well, these may not be legends exactly.
They're not old.
They're
not old legends.
You don't have to be old to be a legend, I guess. But they're certainly two totally iconic gentlemen from American cuisine.
And then the third.
Let's just mention who they are. Mark Miller, who blazed onto the scene with southwestern cuisine.
Yeah.
And Hubert Keller, who's been plying his trade in San Francisco for more years than we would like to remember.
Yeah, and kicking butt on the Iron Chef Masters.
doing that too. And it turns out we caught up with him because his newest line of restaurants is all about burgers, and he wrote a cookbook about them. So he talks about the whole concept of, if you like, the modern alternative burger-style restaurant, and, of course, a reference to his wonderful fleur-de-lis in San Francisco, California. And then finishing up one of the more thoughtful interviews I think we've ever had.
Au revoir to all that.
And Michael Sternberger talking about...
He's wonderful.
The decline and fall, shall we say, of fine dining and so on in France, with good news at the end that suggests that all is not lost. But in the meantime, a totally fascinating book that Anne read from cover to cover, and you should too. So that's the content of today's program. Sounds like an exciting time. Let's get on with it.
Well, now you said it all. Maybe they don't want to listen.
Well, I mean, I tried to make it sound exciting. I'm sure. Okay. I'm sure you're going to love every minute of it.
Well, let's talk. All these people were just delightful and thoughtful, and it's fun talking to them.
So why don't we roll the interviews?
Good.
Mark Miller, you don't want to take credit for this, but in my eye, you dramatically altered the eating style of Americans with your introduction. When was it, of the Curie du Café?
Curie Café opened about 24 years ago.
And, holy Moses.
I started doing restaurants 32 years ago in Berkeley, California.
Uh-huh. What was the first restaurant?
The first restaurant was 4th Street Grill.
Okay.
And that's after I had left work at Chez Panisse with Alice Waters for a couple of years.
Right.
And before that, I was at Berkeley as a student for 8 years in the anthropology department.
So you were an anthropologist, basically.
Anthropology, yes. And that's my sort of link to my interest in intellectually and sort of culinarily in ethnic foods. And seeing the... Well,
wasn't that what got Rick Bayless involved? Wasn't he
Rick
on...
Bayless is actually linguistic.
He was... Okay.
Yeah, but he's very, again, very interested in the portrayal, the authentic portrayal of Mexican food in America. He's done a great job educating people about the complexities of American of Mexican cuisine.
Had you actually studied Mexico in your anthropology, Mark?
No, I used to teach culture of Japan. My main field was cross-cultural aesthetics, or art and culture. And I really look at food as an extension of my studies, and really looking at food as a cultural perceptual system. So when I go into a culture, I really look at the food as one of their cultural systems to understand from a subjective cultural basis. A lot of people think that whether it's good in one culture, it's good universally. That's not necessarily true. We all have the same physiology, but we all don't agree on the same music, we don't agree on the same art, the same drama, the same poetry. We have a lot of differences in the way we express ourselves, and food is one of the great human sort of expressions of culture.
Yeah, well, Ruth Reichel and I both have a master's in art history from the University of Michigan.
and
there's somebody else who has a master's in art history who's also a food person.
No, I was just wondering if anthropologists in their later career say, would you like tacos with that, sir?
I think that, you know, I was very interested in understanding the complexities of primitive art, and I collected and worked in textiles. I worked in Guatemala a little bit.
Oh, I love Guatemala.
With the Eskimo culture, and so, and I have a degree in Song Dynasty painting, 11th century Chinese painting, and so.
When you go to Asia, because your bio says that you divide your time between here and Asia.
Correct. I go to Asia about every 6 weeks. I just came back this weekend from actually a trip of 15 cities and 10 countries in the last 27 days.
Now, are you leading tours? Why are you doing this?
No. I'm continuing to educate myself, and I do work as a consultant for multinational food companies and people like P.F. Chang's and Darden. And
oh, Ryan's. Yeah.
So I'm constantly going to food shows or looking at new food trends and in different places and continuing to educate myself out there in the food world. Unfortunately, I have to eat for a living.
Well, you're missing out a couple of steps here. You also had a landmark restaurant, I think, called Red Sage.
Yes.
Well, which took the nation's capital by storm.
Right. I think Red Sage was in 91, opened in 91, and that was the first large-scale restaurant that embraced the sort of history of the West, not just American regional food, but specifically the food of the West, which I think is our great sort of mythic part of our identity. And so it was, best new restaurant of the United States that year at Esquire, and it did extremely well and had a lot of designs. I used about 29 different artists and artisans from different parts of America to design the restaurant. It was really interesting. It had big thunder clouds as you walked through the doors, and of course it was a block from the White House. The president, George Bush Sr., used to come in and loved our Chipotle breadsticks.
Oh, wow. Is that closed now?
It's gone now. It was there for about 8 years.
There was no broccoli on the menu either, I guess.
No broccoli.
Well, now, the proximate reason for us talking today is that you just wrote a book called Tacos. And
yes,
you described tacos in a very interesting way. Talk about the three trails of tacos.
Well, I think that, you know, tacos are one of the great street foods of the world. Many cultures have what I call three different cultures. They have the home culture of cuisine. There's always the commercial culture of cuisine, which is the restaurant culture. And then you have this sort of intermediary where people are not at home or don't want to go to a restaurant but need to eat. And this becomes the street cultures, the street foods of the world. So I think that when you Singapore, Bangkok, Hong Kong, Japan, we've institutionalized, unfortunately, our street food into chains.
Well, you know, Mark Bittman just tweeted something about this the other day, that he said that the one thing that we lack as a country is street food.
And I think it's part of our over worrying about sort of hygiene. People do not believe that. I was in Berlin, for instance, 2 months ago, and here you have a very modern city that continues to, you have a 20-foot grill burning over wood, 10 different kinds of sausages on basically their main street of Berlin, which would be like Fifth Avenue, with not a kiosk, sort of full-size restaurant serving beer, and you get a wonderful grilled bratwurst that's homemade, that's smoked and grilled over wood for $2.50. You know, in cases like that, I'm perfectly happy to do that. Or you get a bowl of noodles, and in a place I've been eating in Hong Kong for 29 years, for $2.50 made out of fresh, you know, sort of shrimp balls. But tacos, going back to tacos, I think that, tacos for me exemplify the heart and soul of a lot of the Mexican food in terms of its sort of its grittiness, its expressiveness, its sort of its savoriness. I had just come back from 2 weeks in Europe, and I was in Chicago 2 weeks ago, and I was going on the street fair there of Chicago, which is on Sundays.
Yes.
It's this great Hispanic, about 10 blocks long, and there was this wonderful lingua or tongue taco with barbacoa sauce with homemade tortillas, and it was like so happy to have that food in my hand versus some of the food that I was obviously very refined and very good food in places in Europe, but it doesn't have the soul and the expressiveness of something that's warm, that's something that's juicy, and something that's immediate, and being cooked by a woman who obviously has been doing this her whole life, and sitting there. When we talk about, we mentioned the taco trail and the influence of tacos. The immigrants who have come, obviously, to America from Mexico to work, you can, whether it's through the agricultural workers in California, you can trace the towns, and if you go and find, like, in Napa or in Southern California, you will find, as these agricultural communities grow up, there's these wonderful taquerias, like, I call it sort of hidden taco trails. And you can trace, like, one going up to Chicago in the Midwest. You can track one all the way from Tijuana all the way to Seattle and on the West Coast. And you can track one sort of on the East Coast, not as strong, because obviously you have a lot of influence of South Americans and Central Americans in Miami But you have a large group in Washington and some parts of the Northeast, although they tend to stay away from the coldest areas. But it's interesting that you can find great tacos in America almost everywhere if you stay out of some of the, like the chains and some of the commercial places, and really look for a small taqueria in one of the, or the taco trucks, which...
Yeah, I can't ever figure out how to eat one. I've never been able to eat one without... I used to have a dress that I called my taco dress because it was already stained all up in front of it.
She had this wonderful, wonderful lily white Guatemalan dresses with a taco trail down the center.
And then the idea is, you know, again with tacos, is you can build your own food, which I think is one of the wonderful things about Mexican food is you have this basis of a tortilla, which is wonderful, warm corn, and then you have meats that are grilled or roasted or freshly prepared or long simmered, and then you can add this long, Mexican food has this gestalt of its soul, of this long cooking with sort of wonderful, sort of subtle, deep, sort of intense herbs, and then you punctuate that or accessorize that and bring it alive with the fresh cilantro, the fresh onions, the squeeze of lime, the little bit of, you know, salsa verde.
Yeah, how about this one, Dungeness crab with fennel? I mean, that doesn't even sound Mexican.
Well, actually, in Ensenada, where I go to, Ensenada is a great place. It's probably one of the, I would say that there are three places in Mexico. Ensenada is one of them for the best tacos, and they have a wonderful, both seafood and sort of mountain sort of meats there. And I've actually had, not with fennel, I added that myself, but I have had crab tacos in Ensenada that are wonderful, along with, of course, the classic Baja.
Where is this place?
Ensenada is it's about an hour south of Tijuana.
Oh, so it's close to the border.
Yeah, just you can drive there in about 2 hours from San Diego. Wonderful.
I don't know how to explain the excitement of these recipes to people, but they really are. I mean, they're obviously chef-designed, too, huh?
Well, I think they sort of reflect my palate in terms of what I feel is... I try to, as I said before, make them a little bit more modern, more accessible, and some people, when they hear the words like Mexico, they think it has to be greasy or heavy or not healthy. So I wanted to do a balanced presentation of wonderful sort of, you know, things like tongue to wonderful light things that are complete with goat cheese and vegetables and they're also, you can't make a mistake when you make tacos. A lot of people think,
I'm scared to make them. I have to tell you, I cook a lot and I have never made a taco.
Really?
Yeah.
And also, it's a good use of like leftovers. There's what do you do with the rest of the rotisserie chicken you get, you know, at the grocery store? And there's breakfast tacos, which are wonderful.
There's rabbit with chilies and tomatillas.
Well, I also made the rest with, for instance, chicken thighs. If you don't want to, get rabbit or don't want to eat rabbit, it works really well with inexpensive chicken thighs, and you just do the tomatillo and the roasted jalapeno and the herbs, and you put it in foil, put it in the oven, and an hour and a half later, you know, bang, you have a wonderful sort of succulent, sort of really interesting meat.
Now, what's the starting point? The starting point for tacos is a tortilla of some kind.
The tortilla itself is. Right.
Are you supposed to make those yourself, or can you go get them?
I think in the United States, tortillas are available everywhere, and I have never been to a city or town that doesn't have some you know, tortillas available at a grocery store. Certainly, of course, the best tortillas are would come from a tortilla or a place that makes the tortillas fresh masa coming right out of the machine, warm. Even in Santa Fe, we're a small city, we have three places that make homemade tortillas. And then there's different styles of tortillas. There's basically the flour tortilla, which is northern Mexico, very popular in parts of the South and Southern California. The corn tortilla is the preferred traditional one.
Yeah.
And then there's blue corn, and then there's also the soft... Like, when you go to Chipotle, I do like Chipotle, but one of the things I have a problem with them is you can't get soft corn tortillas.
You mean Chipotle where?
Chipotle, the chain. That's all.
Oh, you like that chain?
Yeah. Uh-huh. They have good, you know, sort of barbacoa or long simmered meats. They use Neiman Ranch. They're very popular, but they don't have a good corn tortilla.
Yeah. Now, you worked with P.F. Chang's, you said.
Yeah, I work with Payway, the division of P.F. Chang's, which is their casual, fast casual division. We have about 180 restaurants in the United States.
Huh.
at about 190 PFCHANG. Very good company, great food, no preservatives, no MSG, things made to order, which I really believe is still
They don't very even affordable. Have microwaves in the kitchen, they said. They told me.
Excuse me?
They don't even have microwaves in their kitchen.
No, everything's cut in, brought in fresh every day, and everything's cut by hand, and everything's, the dumplings and everything are made daily by hand. But every piece of chicken is cut, every piece of steak, flank steak is cut by hand, and everything is walk cooked to order. We don't pre-cook anything.
But they don't have tacos.
They don't have tacos. Well, actually, we have a new wrap. We actually have some Asian wraps in some of our newer stores in Denver where we're sort of using a tortilla, flour tortilla, using rice, and then using some of the elements like stir-fried, wok-fried elements that go into it, which creates a really good wrap.
Now, you talked about crab tortillas and ensenada. Can you pick a two or three of your other favorites? I mean, the one I liked flashing by the pictures was one that had a fried egg in it.
Oh, that's some of the breakfast tacos. I think you're looking at the divorciados, the one that had the two sauces of the red and green sauce.
I don't know. Anne was just leafing through the book. I saw that going by. But
there's this whole tradition, which I really, really love, and I wish that's one of the things I wish we would have more of. I am not a sweet pastry or a coffee drinker. I always prefer to eat savory foods in the morning.
Me too.
And I find it so hard as a traveler that when I go to airports, for instance, I'll look for a taco place, you know, to eat tacos for breakfast, but something chicken or steak or something, or scrambled eggs with chorizo. But there's the wonderful tradition in the book of breakfast tacos, especially in San Antonio and places like Dallas, where you can go in and you have your corn, fresh warm corn tortillas, and you can have your scrambled eggs, or you just put the tortillas down and, you know, you put the fried eggs on top with the sauce. Some people would call that maybe not a taco. I still call it, you know, anything you build on top of a tortilla still becomes a taco.
Okay, you have another favorite?
I think that, let's see, we talked about the rabbit ones, which are really simple. Well, not the rabbit or the other ones. Carnitas, very simple. I love carnitas, you know, basically the cooked pork. There's the fennel. There's an interesting Thai one there. That for people like modern Thai flavors, we do it in a crispy shell. There's a lobster one. I come from New England, so I had to put a lobster one in. It's a sort of a new Southwest version of the lobster or the lobster sandwich. When you say one of my favorites, I could eat every single one in that book every day.
Yeah, I mean, I'm getting hungry just reading this stuff. But do you think we'll make one of these? I mean, do you think this is going to be easy for people to pick up and start making tacos?
Yeah, I purposely like when I design my salsa book, I design the salsas so that they could be done in 20 minutes. I try to avoid any difficult cooking technique or need of expensive equipment or even expensive ingredients. The fact is, you start with a good tortilla, you put your food in a hot pot, you cook it on a grill, you chop it up, you do a couple salsas. It seems complex, but essentially the steps are extremely simple. You're talking about steps that take 5 or 10 minutes, really.
Huh.
You know, so, and then also you're not eating so much, and then you can, as I said, you can use it for, I like the idea that tacos can be individualized. You can personalize your own taco. You can flavor it to the how, you know. I think the success of tacos or a hot dog or to some extent a hamburger is that we always want to make our food our own. And sometimes you can't do that. When you get something like a lasagna in front of you, there's not much you can put a little bit more cheese on, but you can't actually personalize it. And I think in today's times, people want to have food that really is their unique sort of way of the seasoning and tacos. When I see people, that's when it was also universal. When you go to a taco stand in Mexico, you'll find a lawyer with a briefcase, you'll find daily workers, you'll find average homemakers, you'll find kids, mothers. Everybody is sitting around those benches or standing up, eating the same taco and then creating their own special taco. It brings people together to have a wonderful food like this. The minute you start either making it too expensive or making it only one flavor, or like a chain does sometimes, or creating only one type of food, I think you don't create that commonality. And food is one of those great connectors of creating communities. And what I love about tacos is you can go at 12 o'clock at night and you see a different group of people. You can go at 6 o'clock in the morning in Mexico. And I think that's one of the things that we need more of is bringing. See if somebody will say, oh, I never go to McDonald's. Well, there's nothing wrong with McDonald's and their prices and their food. I think it's just that they haven't created that social community around it. People don't go to know, like, there's a lot of popularity of eating food out, for instance, at farmers markets in San Francisco or Pittsburgh. I'm sure you have a good farmers market there, right?
We have one of the as a city per capita, we have probably, we're in the top two or three farmers market centers in the country.
Picked for the G20.
The farmers, the farmers markets will still be open, just about. The difficulty we have is the shortness of season.
But don't you find that when people are talking to a grower or there's somebody cooking something that's part of what they grow, or more than willing to, they feel much more connected to their food supply when you can be handed the food by the person who actually cares and makes it and is. And it represents.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
I think that's one of the things about the taco trucks. You go to a city in Los Angeles, and people will say Michoacan. They'll actually say on the truck what part of Mexico they're from. And those people who either want to have a different style or are from that area will go there. They don't go to a generic taco place that represents, you know, we have made our food generic, and it doesn't necessarily. It's not necessarily successful. I think that people want to have more choices today.
Well, this book, I think, is full of choices. And, I mean, I love the flavors. I wish, Mark, you could just come and cook them all for me.
Well, I wish I was there to feed you some of those wonderful tacos, because I think we would stop talking and do more eating.
Yeah, I guess so.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you so much for joining us.
Mark,
and,
you're swell. I'm glad I finally got to talk to you.
The book is, if people are interested in it, there's a good preview. They have the whole introduction and some chapters, of course, on Amazon, but they've done a good job in promoting it, and Ten Speed did a great job as my publisher, and I'm redoing the Chili book this year. So it's been out 20 years. So
I've never gotten a copy of that. I would like a copy of that. Who's putting that?
Ten Speed Press. They'll be in the publicity department. They'll be glad to get you a copy.
Who is
of
it?
Books. Ten Speed Press.
Oh, yeah, they're nice to us.
Yeah,
they're very good to
they're
us.
The book, and they published the taco book, and they've been great for me and great for a lot of chef authors.
Oh, thank you.
Well,
they're good people.
I love chili, so I'm waiting for that book to come out. I can hardly wait.
Well, it's been out 20 years. I'm going to do the remodel. This one will do. I'm going to touring this summer all the paprika factories of Hungary and for instance Spain, and we're going to look at the sweet paprikas, the sour, the smoked paprikas, how they're made. Going into places Tunisia, back in Morocco, looking at the dried chili traditions and the harissas there.
So this is an expanded, or is it just reprinted?
It's going to be an expanded book, and it's going to be of a culinary tool. Whereas the first one really described the flavor profiles of each chili very well. This one is actually going to look at the world of chilies as an ingredient, the chili kitchen of the world.
Yeah, I did a chili tasting with Deanna Bayless. I was absolutely amazed. We could, and we weren't allowed when we described it to use terms hot.
No, that's I started that. I was the one that said, the first one to write about chilies in terms of their success.
Well, Mark,
the first chili book.
Mark, we have a date when the next chili book comes out. In the meantime, thank you so much for joining us on the menu.
Thank you very much for your support, and more tacos.
Oh, more tacos, yes. Come visit.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mark. Bye-bye.
And now it's time to take a break. I snuck one in on you, sweetheart. I did it this time, but you can do it next time.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We're back, and we're asking you to check us out on our webpage, and you'll be able to check us out on Facebook, on Twitter, on the blog. All you have to do is click on our www.onthemenuradio.com website.
And there are buttons there for your use for that purpose. And here we are back again. And next up on this program is Hubert Keller, a fleur-de-lis restaurant in California. Although there's a sort of a French connection there. I think that Mr. Keller might be a little French in the background there, but his cooking certainly is.
He's on a
totally new shtick, shall we call it. Which is not unique to him, but a lot of fine restaurateurs have been going down the path of doing creative things with that good old comfort food of all Americans, the burger. And he has a highly innovative take on it based on his restaurants called Burger Bars. And you can cook like Burger Bars by looking at
the cookbook that we talked to him about. So welcome, Hubert Keller. I'm sure you're going to enjoy listening to him too.
I think I can spot a trend when I see it, but we're going to be talking to Hubert Keller, who is most known as the four-star chef at Fleur-de-Lis in San Francisco, and then subsequently his three restaurants. Well, one is under construction. The other is in Las Vegas, Hubert, right? And the other one is in St. Louis?
And one is in St. Louis, yes, Missouri.
And they're called Burger Bars, and that's what they're about. And that's what we're going to be talking about, your book, where you put all your ideas about burgers in between two hardcovers.
Yes, that's right. And the book actually just came out. It's called Burger Bar also. And really kind of the book is based what the menu at Burger Bar is based about, because the concept is build your own. So what really the Burger Bar is about, it's a whole collection of burgers, and it goes anywhere from different kinds of beef that you can choose from, also some salmon, turkey, chicken, buffalo, I mean, and vegetarian, you really name it. So we have all kinds of burgers. And then from the bakery, you can actually pick your bun. And then after that, you have a huge variety of choices when it comes to toppings. We have about 35 toppings, and then you really build up your own burger. So it's a lot of fun, and that's why the Burger Bar is such a success. So the book is about the same idea on me giving ideas of burgers and different sides, and then I'm giving you some options in there also, so you really can take off and basically create your own burger.
So the whole idea was that people could cook for themselves what you serve in your burger bar restaurants, assuming that they're not close by?
Yes, I think exactly, yeah. So they can kind of reproduce what we're doing at the Burger Bar. But also I think it will help on really thinking a little bit out the box, right? I think that's what lately all those burger restaurants are about, when you're going to the chef's restaurants, where really we're putting some thought behind, we're coming up some cool combinations. And I think really the burger is not just bacon and cheese, right? I think it can be really in all different kind of directions, and even pretty fun and entertaining.
Now, I did notice in the introduction a couple of very helpful hints, especially for people making burgers with beef. And we had come across some of the same tips in a book produced by the Lobo brothers, the butchers on Madison Avenue in New York.
Oh, okay.
And they had many of the same thoughts as you did about the importance of the meat and how freshly it should be ground and how it shouldn't be tightly packaged. Give us listeners a couple of examples of this basic sound stuff that will ensure that you have a better burger.
Yeah, I think what really, when it's, to have a great result, right, either you buy some ground meat or some frozen patties, where it's one thing, right? But on the other hand, I think to have a great burger, why not just going to your butcher, right, and buy the meat and just ask him to either run it himself to the meat grinder at that moment, so that it hasn't been grinded 2 days before, right? So that's one thing. Plus, when they're grinding it, you don't even know exactly what goes in there. So at least you have the insurance, actually. That you have a great burger. And then when you take the grind meat at home, I think by shaping the patties, I think you really should not overwork it, because as soon you compress that burger too much, then it becomes like the consistency of a stuffing, and the burger is not like that nice and juicy burger and airy burger. So that's one thing. And then also I never recommend to season the burger, let's say, 2 hours before. You can season the burger if you want to flavor it with some herbs and some spices. But when it comes to the salt, leave the salt on the last moment, because the salt really, when it comes in contact with the meat, starts on curing the meat. And so again, you would have more like forced meat, right? A kind of a consistency, like a farce, when you make it ahead of time. So I personally recognize, and that's what we do at the Burger Bar. We basically just season those burgers before they go on the grill on the last moment.
Now, this is exactly what Lobo said. In fact, he said something really interesting, which is the opposite of what I've been doing for a long time. I used to form the burgers in my hand, and they would naturally be rather round. And he said that's absolutely the opposite of what you should do. You should actually make the sides of the burger concave, pressed in a little bit, because what will happen when they cook is that they'll expand outwards and then they'll be flat, which is exactly what you want them to be. So these kinds of suggestions are really fundamental to making sure that you get a good burger. I mean, the recipes are great, but if you start out with an ingredient that's just not quite right, then you won't get the result you're looking for.
You're totally right, Peter. I think it starts with ingredient, but also, I must say, I'm not the biggest fan from a flat patty. I think our burgers are really some nice, like, 8-ounce burgers and have quite some height in it. And that reason for that is really, if you want a nice and juicy burger, then in the same time, also treat that burger like you would treat the most expensive meat that basically just bought. What, like, if you ordered, let's say, a ribeye, or if you had a filet mignon and you knew you spent a lot of money in it, you probably would respect it probably even more so, right? But I think in order, when you cook enough, you put them either on a grill or on a flat top or in a cast iron pan, and you really sear nicely on one side. Then you sear it on the other side, so really you're sealing the burger and all the juices are staying inside. And another thing that I personally don't recommend is putting some weight on it, because it's almost you're like walking on that burger, right? And squeeze out all the juices, right?
What a funny idea.
It's better you let it sear, you let it cook, and then any kind of large piece of meat, you would actually set it aside and let it rest for 3 or 4 minutes so that the juices are really nicely distributed in that burger or in that piece of beef, and that's exactly the same in a burger. You cook it, if you had it like medium or medium rare, let it sit for like about 3 minutes so that the juices are going through that burger, and then put them on the patty, and then when you eat it, it's actually the patty who soaks up those juices, and that one makes another great burger.
It's so satisfying to get a great burger. I mean, we did this. We broke down and split a Kobe burger in New York when we were there, and it was a 22-ounce burger. But I hadn't had one that good in such a long time. It was just great. But part of this book, I think, Hubert, is you have so many creative ideas. I mean, I'm looking through here. You have a salmon filet burger. You have a Las Vegas veggie burger. You've got seared tuna burger. You have, I mean, they're just BLT turkey club burger, a macaroni and cheese burger. And you even have dessert burgers.
Yes, and I think we're pretty unique for that. And I do think the Burger Bar really is the place where we launch the sweet burgers, where it's kind of, you can see in the book,
for example,
we have the chocolate burger or the s'more burger.
S'more burger
is really lots of fun, right? It's taken from basically from the classic, right? When you have marshmallow and you have little cookies.
Uh-huh.
So I took a little bit of that idea, right, where by pushing in, and you can tell we had lots of fun on putting those burgers together.
How many calories are in the chocolate hazelnut burger on a glazed donut?
Yeah, and you're totally right. Yeah, I reproduce, it's like a trompe-l'œil. So it's when you see the burger, it really looks like a burger. But what it is, it's actually a donut without a hole in the center, and it's glazed, and that's actually the bun. And then the patty, I'm using a rich ganache with some nuts in it. So it's really, that's the patty. And of course, some fresh fruit, like little kiwis and strawberries. And then what really looks like the cheese melting on top of that burger, that's actually a little gelée that I make with passion fruit. And I put a little gelée inside, and I just pour it in little sheet pans, and it's pretty simple to do. And then I cut out the little square lined with the plastic, right, and I just peel off the plastic, and it really looks like it's a piece of cheese, right? So people are amused by it, and we have a lot of fun with this burger.
Now, and asked how many calories.
Yes.
Well, how many calories? I haven't figured that one out exactly, but it's if you're on a diet, it's probably not exactly the burger you're looking for.
Yeah.
But a little bit excess one day, really you can work it out the next day, right? But really, really great.
So you also have sides in here.
Yes.
Classic sides. And these cocktails. Tell us what kind of sides you call for.
You know, when it comes to sides, you really have anywhere from different kinds of bacons. We have some grenadine pickled onions in the other extreme, right? And then we go through all the different kind of French fries also that we're having, from anywhere, zucchini fries, fat fries, sweet potato fries. So other things like a little bit less traditional, like tapenade, like a spread which is made out of olives. I'm giving a little recipe where you make a very quick way to make your own mustard, for example, which is another great way on enjoying a burger and to make things quite easy, right? We have, let's say, a spicy red pepper tomato relish who goes on it. And then you name it, you can go on and on. We have, like I said, about 30, 40.
I noticed you have onion rings here.
Yes.
Beer battered onion rings. It's funny. I love onion rings, and we had some at a restaurant
which shall be nameless.
In New York.
No, it was actually in San Francisco, but I will still make it nameless because you've never seen such a pile. I mean, it was a bargain at $8 for a serving of onion rings, but all the batter fell off.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that isn't any good when you pick them up.
Well,
the batter
version
fell off.
I thought you were going to explain how they also served it as a separate course.
I think they forgot them. they did not go side by side with what they were supposed to go side by side with. But that would never happen at a burger bar.
And here you
no,
have
I don't think so, no.
That
no,
Brazilian no, no. pickled vegetables look great. And, of course, everybody's pickling these days.
Yes, yeah, it's true. It's also things that people are really discovering. And again, I think people go more and more into this kind of things because, first of all, it's so inexpensive to make it. It's pretty simple to make it. And you have kind of an excitement, right, when you make it by yourself. Plus, if you do, let's say, set an hour aside and you do pickled vegetables or whatever, you know it's not like something that you eat. It's like a course, right? You're eating in 5 minutes. You pickle those, you put them in your refrigerator. You have the things for weeks in there, right? It makes it exciting each time you probably see it. Plus, you see, I think, that evolution, right, of flavors. So you really feel like you contributed something to it because the moment that what you're putting in jars and the time you're really eating it, and let's say a week later you eat it, you see a progression in there, right? So it makes it exciting.
Well, I think that anybody seriously interested in pursuing this, burgers and sides, and you even have drinks in here, they should get this book. I mean, it's a smallish book, but it's just packed with information. I'm sorry we've never met. I mean, really feel bad that we've never met. Maybe next trip to San Francisco.
Oh, you absolutely have to stop by at Philly this year when you're coming to San Francisco. Absolutely. It's a must. And maybe when you're coming to San Francisco, that the new burger bar that is under construction right now will be open. It's right downtown.
Now, where's that going to be, and when's the opening slated, Hubert?
So the opening is planned so far beginning of September.
Okay.
And the burger bar is located, right on Union Square, downtown at Macy's at the sixth floor. So you will be overlooking the entire Union Square.
Okay, so it's in the department store on the.
That's right.
And I guess not Post Street, the one below that, on the bottom side of Union Square.
That's correct. Yeah, yeah. Yes. Looking up, you would see the cable cars on your left hand side and going up Broadway.
How's Fleur-de-Lis holding up? That's a very upscale restaurant.
Yes, Fleur-de-Lis, you know, is holding up quite well, I must say. Chantal, my wife, and myself, we have that restaurant now for the last 23 years. So it's here definitely for a long time, right? But I think since we established with the locals and actually, I think, some clientele, I think even in tougher times like we're going through, I guess we all feel it, right? But definitely we're still going pretty well. I think just because we're here for so long, and I think we went through a recession already, we went through an earthquake, and we made it back. We actually made it through a fire when in 2001, unfortunately, we lost the restaurant in a fire, and we rebuilt it. So that's just like another wave that we're passing here.
I see. And, of course, your place in Vegas is in the right category, but fine dining is down 40% in Vegas.
Yeah, fine dining in Las Vegas, I must say, is a little bit hit, I must say. Yeah, like I said, in many other cities, but Las Vegas, yes, they are hit.
Very heavy, yeah.
But the fun part is, again, if you look at that burger bar, it has not stopped yet, and thanks God, on one side. But again, it shows you it's like comfort food is something that people can afford, and I think also what have changed, it's a restaurant experience. You get a real napkin, you sit down on a table. We're actually taking your order, and so it's still kind of an experience. You're going out, right? And and we have lots of beers. If you're a beer lover, we have about 130 beers by the bottle. We have 24 beers on draft. So right there, it's like another draw, right, to have like a great beer and a great burger.
Sounds good to me.
And you can do the same at home thanks to this terrific book. So thank you for your contribution to the world of comfort food and drinking.
Thank you, Peter, for having me. Thank you, Anne, for having me. Really, it was a great pleasure.
And so we'll see you next time we go west.
Absolutely. Please come see me.
Okay.
And you have a great day. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks.
Bye-bye,
Hubert.
Bye-bye.
And I think we'll take another break here.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station. www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again.
Here we are. See, I was going to race you, but then I thought, no, that really wouldn't be fair, because I know when the sound's coming up and you don't. Even though I give you a thumbs up, I could be cheating.
I see.
But anyway, we talked about Michael Steinberger's book about the cuisine of France and the fact that it might be on its last legs, as it were. Fascinating book, fascinating man to talk to. Listen to this interview all the way through, and I think if you're interested at all in French dining, you'll find it quite fascinating.
You know, I know I'm reading a good book when right at the beginning the author says, "This is how I lost my wife to French cuisine." And a little bit later, I'll tell you a similar story that occurred in our life. But why don't you start out with that wonderful little insight into the glory of French cuisine when you first really experienced it?
Well, why don't we mention who we're talking to?
Oh, we should, I guess. Yeah, it's Michael. Everybody knows.
Michael Steinberger, and his book is Au Revoir to All That, hot off press, Food, Wine, and the End of France. It's nothing if not bold. Welcome, so, Michael.
Thank you very much for having me.
And go ahead, tell us how you almost lost your wife.
Well, I was in Strasbourg. We were out for dinner. This was in September 1999. We were out for dinner at a restaurant called Le Crocodile, which then had 3 Michelin stars, and its chef, Emile Jung, was one of the great practitioners of haute cuisine in Alsace, and one of his signature dishes there is a back-off of the foie gras. Back-off is an Alsatian specialty made with meat and vegetables, but in his case, he happened to make a fancified version of this with a whole lobe of foie gras in place of the meats, and it was just an absolutely amazing dish. I mean, just we just sat there for 10 minutes while eating this dish, and then towards the end of the evening, Jung came over to our table, in the way that chefs always sort of make the rounds, and my wife was then working for a food magazine in New York and was just asking about some of the preparations, and he seemed quite smitten with her to the point of ignoring me, and eventually asked her if she wanted to take a tour of the kitchens and so forth, and she said yes, and he said, "We'll leave him here," and he made it seem like he was joking, but I knew he wasn't, and so I stayed at the table, just happily finishing my wine, and just really sort of almost catatonic from this foie gras, and they were gone a long time, and, you know, it was late in the evening, we were basically the last people left in the restaurant. Madame Jung, who ran the front of the house, eventually came over, perhaps to commiserate with me, sensed that maybe this wasn't the first time her husband had taken a shine to a young, attractive female guest, and came over to commiserate with me, and I just, you know, I couldn't get the words out because I was, as I said, sort of catatonic from this dish, which was really one of the greatest dishes I ever tasted.
Oh, dear.
Now,
if I could have said something to her, I would have said, "Look, your husband just served me one of the finest dishes I've ever had. If having the company of the pleasure of my wife's company for a few minutes, if that's what he wants, it's a small price to pay for the bliss he just gave me." I didn't say that to her, but if I could have gotten the words out, I would have. And the fact that I looked so fine with everything somewhat seemed to take her aback. And in any event, he eventually returned to the table with my wife, and she came back bearing gifts, an entire quail stuffed with foie gras.
Yeah, which you ate on the way home. But let's continue on, because we could talk about that story for a long time. But curiously enough, this little anecdote is almost counter to your theme, because this anecdote suggests that fine dining is alive and well in France, and your thesis is the opposite of that.
Well, it is, and to be perfectly honest, I wanted to start the book with something like that for the simple reason I want to establish the fact that I am a Francophile, that I am someone who loves France deeply and loves it largely because it has fed me so well over the years. And I thought it was important in a book that includes in the subtitle the words "The End of France," I thought it was important to establish the fact that I am a Francophile and that this is really a love letter to France, from a concerned friend. I guess that's the way I would.
That sounds good.
Yeah. Now you've got there are a number of major points that you make in the book that suggest why this is happening. Can you just bring those to the forefront for us?
Well, the decline of French cuisine, I argue in the book, is rooted in a couple things. Obviously, you have had changes in French households. You've got many, many women in the workplace now, something that wasn't the case 40 or 50 years ago. And while that is certainly a step forward for women in France, it has not redounded to the benefit of French cuisine necessarily, because obviously, just like here in the States, two-income households, one of the things that falls by the wayside is home-cooked meals. And that has certainly been the case in France. Less cooking being done in the home, that means young palates aren't being cultivated the way they used to be. And for French haute cuisine, that is a very big development indeed, because almost to a person, all of the great chefs to this day had their interest in food nurtured in the home by their mothers and grandmothers. And so that is not happening. So you've got that umbilical cord being cut. There's also another factor has been French complacency. And, you know, it's a perfectly understandable thing. When you've been at the top so long, when you've been the unrivaled kings of gastronomy, you do sort of tend to become complacent. And that's been a factor, too. But a much bigger factor, I argue, is that for 30 years, France has been stagnant economically. We've had basically 30 years of sluggish growth, of high unemployment, of stagnant living standards, and you've also had, and this is a particular problem for chefs and restaurants, you've had the creation of a business climate that is distinctly hostile to businesses, and particularly small and medium-sized businesses. And I don't think it's terribly controversial to say that there is a connection between economic prosperity and gastronomic prosperity. And France has stagnated economically for the better part of the last 30 years, and French cuisine has suffered for that.
Now, in a number of places in your book, you also seem to be saying that individual establishments that you visited are just not up to the standard that they used to be. Is it that the owners are getting bored, or are they getting tired, or what's the reason behind that?
Well, I mean, there are a variety of factors. I think it's become very difficult to run a restaurant in France. Has become very, very difficult. And it's become difficult for a number of reasons. For one thing, you've got just so much bureaucratic red tape that you have to deal with. It's astonishing. You talk to restaurant owners, and it could be a bistro, a simple corner bistro, it could be a three-star restaurant, just the amount of red tape they have to deal with. They've got 35-hour work week. They have reams of paperwork that they have to provide. All sorts of government agencies have their hands in their wallets and require documentation for this, for that, the other thing. It is such a time drain for so many of these chefs and restaurant owners. You have, because of that, and because of things like the 35-hour work week, which has made it very difficult to staff positions, because of the high tax rates on businesses, and because of the high taxes levied on restaurant meals, the 19.6% value-added tax, which has been just a nightmare for the culinary industry. For all these factors, it's become very difficult to keep these restaurants, and bistros, brasseries, three-star restaurants, it's become very difficult to keep them thriving, to keep them in business in many cases, but to keep thriving and to put good food on the table. And, of course, the flip side of this is that with stagnant living standards in France, with many French economically pinched, a lot of people don't have the money to go to places, and so you got it from both sides. And so you see favorite restaurants falling by the wayside. You see basically a cuisine that is really struggling.
Okay, so you think it's struggling for its soul just a little bit as well?
Well, there's that too. But I think I think certainly the rise of Spain. We're talking about haute cuisine. We've seen over the last 15 years the rise of Spain. And what I argue in the book is that one aspect of that has been that, up until recently anyway, Spain was economically dynamic in a way that France was not. Beginning in the mid-1970s with the end of the Franco era, the birth of Spanish democracy, you had an incredible economic takeoff in Spain. And on the back of this, you had this culinary flowering take place with Ferran Adria, with Arfak in San Sebastian, and so many others.
But, you know, the basis for this this revolution of the Basque kitchen, and I just wrote an article about it a while back.
Actually, came from France.
It came from the Nouvelle Cuisine in the Bocuse.
Well, he's exactly right, and that's an interesting point you raise, because in one of the things I talk about in the book is the way that the rest of the world is eating so much better. So you've got this thing where the rest of the world is really eating so much better, and France is stagnating. France is declining. The United States, Britain, Spain are rising. And one of the points I make, and it's the point you just raised, is that France deserves a lot of the credit for this. In the cases of Britain and the United States, you had all these French chefs who came over in the 60s and 70s, when, you know, certainly the United States was very much a culinary wasteland. Like Andre
Raymond Bloch says he single-handedly rescued British cuisine, and he probably did.
Well, that's exactly right. And Michel Roux, along with his brother out there, I mean, they went to London. You had people like Andre Saltner coming to the United States.
Right.
And, I mean, these were tough times to be French chefs here. But they created a market for their cuisine. They created markets for, you know, locally farmed produce and all sorts of the good things that we now take for granted. And so the French deserve a lot of the credit for this. In the case of Spain, you had that seminal moment in 1976 when Bocuse went to Madrid and talked at a culinary seminar there, and Juan Marie Arzak and
Bersaglieri,
and the guy from Macalari,
Chef Macalari.
Yeah, right.
From San Sebastian were in the audience, and they were hearing about all these great things going on in France with Nouvelle Cuisine, and they talked to Bocuse. He invites them to Spain. He invites them to Lyon to hang out with them, to go see the Trois Gros brothers. They go back to San Sebastian and say, hey, we're going to do for Basque cuisine what these guys are doing for French cuisine. And the next thing you know, you've got a culinary revolution taking place.
But they never abandoned the importance of their classical adherence to quality ingredients, which is one of the things that you mentioned talking about the decline of cheese and wine, in particular in France.
Yes. And, you know, these.
So who's responsible for that? Nobody caring much anymore.
Well, with cheese, it's an interesting story. I mean, it's. And the decline has been dramatic. You know, 40 years ago, basically 100% of the cheeses in France were raw milk. Le cru cheeses, which in the view of aficionados are the only cheeses that are real cheeses.
Yes.
And now you're down to maybe 10%. And you've had several dozen cheeses that have gone extinct over the last 25 years.
That's very sad.
Small little artisanal cheeses, in many cases very obscure cheeses, but nonetheless cheeses that were certainly part of France's culinary ecology, and they've gone extinct because no one was around to continue to make them. No one had the desire to continue to make them. One of the things you've seen in France over the last four, the abandonment of the French countryside to a very great extent. I mean, the depopulation of rural France has been a big, big story. 40 years ago, basically 20% of the French workforce worked in agriculture. Now it's less than 5%. And so you got a declining number of people with the ability and desire to make these artisanal cheeses. And because they are pricier cheeses than, you know, the sort of, you know, generic stuff you get in the supermarket, and because most French do their shopping now in the supermarkets, these big hypermarchés as they're called, you don't have enough people to support these little artisans making these cheeses. So you've had that, you know, as cheese goes, that's been the real story there. And
now your wine is a different story. I mean, that's the regulation that really is contributing.
Well, regulation is a big thing. You've got
and then the decline, the
similarity there is that in the same way that you've seen a decline in the consumption of quality cheeses and the willingness to pay for quality cheeses in France, you've seen an absolutely amazing decline in wine consumption in France. It's declined 50% over the last 40 years.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Which is amazing. And admittedly, it started at a very high level. You know, this is an amazing thing. And it has come down. Initially, it started tumbling for the same reason that the multiple martini lunch went out of fashion here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. I mean, just changing cultural and social mores. You know, drinking at lunch became unacceptable. And so in France, people stopped taking a bottle of wine at lunch and then stopped drinking even a glass or two at lunch. The French government also in the mid-1990s waged a very strenuous campaign to bring alcohol consumption in general down because France had a very high incidence of drunk driving deaths. And but the government, they succeeded in bringing down the road fatalities tied to alcohol, which is a very good thing. But somewhere along the line, the French government became almost, I think you would say, neo-prohibitionist. They now are out to discourage drinking just generally, whether you're out at a restaurant or in your home. I mean, you've had these crazy cases where, for instance, they banned all sorts of liquor advertising on the internet.
Right.
They used to make a distinction between alcoholic beverages and wine, because wine, between other alcoholic beverages and wine, because wine was always considered a category apart. It was such a fabric of French culture, and they don't do that anymore. And so now they've banned internet advertising and alcohol. You had this case in Paris in 2008 where a newspaper was sanctioned for running a pre-holiday story about champagne because, the court ruled that this amounted to a form of advertising. They are now trying to do, there's been legislation to make it, to require wineries to charge visitors for tastes, which, when you're a wine writer like me, that's a truly horrifying prospect. And so, they have succeeded. I mean, people in France are not drinking wine in anything like the numbers, the quantities that they used to, and this has created a crisis. You've got hundreds, thousands of small winemakers in places like the Languedoc region, in the Beaujolais region, and most interestingly, in Bordeaux, who are basically financially destitute.
Yeah, it's a terrible thing, isn't it? Now, let's look forward, because...
Yeah, I mean, I think that the listeners have probably at this point realized this book is so dense with information that we can't do it justice.
You have a view of the future that is not all pessimism. You see some reasons for optimism. Perhaps before we sign off, you can share what those are.
Absolutely. I think, this is a country that's been doing great food for many, many years, and 30 years in the span of, 400 or 500 years is hopefully just a blip. There are lots of good things happening in France. You've got, for instance, a number of young chefs concentrated in Paris who have said, we've got a situation where, it's become very difficult to do high-end cuisine in sort of ostentatious settings, the three-star Michelin settings. People don't want that anymore. So we're going to do three-star food in bistro settings at prices people can afford. And so they've gone off to, in some cases, some of the less glamorous parts of Paris and opened these really fantastic restaurants where you can eat exceptionally well for not a lot of money, 30-35 euro set menu. The movement has even acquired a nickname. It's called Bistronomy.
Funny.
It's spearheaded by some of the most talented young chefs in France, people who in another era would have unquestionably been 2 or 3 star recipients, but they don't want that. The clientele doesn't want that. The clientele, in many cases, doesn't have the kind of money to spend on 3-star meals, so they're giving it to them in a different way. You've had other young chefs who have said, we've got this creative challenge from Spain now. Spain seems to have stolen our thunder. We're going to meet this challenge, and we're doing very creative, often eclectic cuisine. Some of it is a little wide of the mark. It's a matter of taste, of course, but some of it is excellent, and the point is they are trying to reinvigorate French cuisine in the face of formidable obstacles, economy, and so forth, and they're making great progress. So there are very optimistic. There are some very promising developments amid all the bad news.
So you're on the whole, you're optimistic or pessimistic
about the future?
I'm cautiously hopeful. I think there are a lot of people in France who realize what's been lost and who would like to arrest the slide, turn things around. And my hope is that in some very small way, this book, written by an outsider but someone who loves France, will in some very small way can perhaps encourage more people to be aware of what's been lost and to prevent more things from being lost and to give this glorious cuisine renewed dynamism.
Now, the listeners, the book again is called
Au Revoir to All That: Food, Wine, and the End of France by Michael Steinberger, who is you're a very empathetic guy to this country. So I think that your hope is probably going to be realized that this will in some part help.
It's also,
I hope so. I haven't tried to go into France since the book came out. I don't know if I'm going to be permitted back in, but I hope so, because there's still a lot of things I like to eat there.
I think when people in authority who have open minds think about it, you'll probably get the Legion of Honor. So and I think you'll deserve it for a very, very thoughtfully arranged, fascinating details throughout the book. I want to go all the places you went.
I'd be happy to do it again and have you join me.
And find out, is it really like that? And in the meantime, I think those of us who enjoy going to France, we all have our fingers crossed. We hope that the last vestige of fine French cuisine will not be in England and the United States. We'll continue to grow in its native land in its own inimitable way. And Michael, thank you so much for joining us on the menu, and we wish you a speedy recovery from your Achilles tendon injury, which you're nursing right now.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. It's a pleasure to join you.
I think that Michael Steinberger is such a fascinating man. Our conversation went on long after the recording stopped. I hope he's writing another book. I'd like to talk to him again. It'd be fun hanging out with him in Paris. Anyhow, I think that about wraps it for today. You've been very chatty, so I'm getting chatty at the end. But we're going to be saying adieu ourselves, right? Bye-bye.